once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. And here in the studio, we have gathered a group of people dedicated to reporting and discussing the truth that exists in the world still somewhere. So I want to say hello to Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Mike. Good day.
I want to say hello to Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Good morning. No alternate facts here.
And I want to say hello to Zaz Hollander.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Zaz. So one of the things that has been happening lately is we last week talked about the question of news, alternative facts, how in this modern world we go about the business of reporting things that are happening with some assurance that we have not come in and distorted what's there by our own bias as a part of the media. And Zaz was not here last week to hear that, but maybe we could start off before we go to some of the details of things that have actually been happening, we think. How do you deal with that? How do you decide? Do you look at something? Do you have to see it with your own eyes and hear it with your own ears? Or how do you deal with reports coming from other people of information?
Well, I mean, I think the same rules have always applied, and that is, you know, you don't believe your mother. You fact check everything. I think with this administration, the media needs to be especially careful to traffic in facts, and either it's a fact or it's not. But the new layer here is that the media is finding itself having to fact check as we go along during interviews, and you know, if we know something isn't a fact, you know, the latest is Kellyanne Conway and the Bowling Green massacre, and there wasn't one. There were two gentlemen in the Bowling Green area, and there were some issues involved with them, but there was no massacre. You know, interestingly, I think all media outlets are kind of trying to get our feet underneath us. And Reuters recently released a primer for its journalists on how to cover the Trump administration. And while they didn't say covering the Trump administration is like working in a third world country or covering an authoritarian regime, the primer basically said, look, we've done that before. You know, our journalists have been in countries where they faced physical harm, so we can do this too.
So one of the things that continually comes up is the question of, and I keep returning to it, how different are the circumstances now than times past or within people's memory? Whether we go back to Obama or Bush or Clinton, I know that historians and people who follow these things over years, who have many years in place, have said in a variety of different ways, the way in which at this highest level in the country, the press and the interaction with the president and people around him is not the way we are used to doing this. And it, not only that, but as you pointed out, one example, there seems to be a willingness to say something and not retract if later confronted, and someone points to evidence and says, well, that's not true. It's not a nuance. It's not a spin. It's simply not true. And I can tell you that locally, wherever I go, I'm seeing far more discussion about news and people and the reports than I think I've had before. I don't think it's just me in a bubble of people chattering, but that seems to be also substantiated by a lot of other reports. Terry?
Well, I think Zaz spoke to it really well. I do think you're sort of flying the plane as you're building it, so to speak. It is a new way of doing it. I think what I'm seeing a little bit more, which I'm glad to see, is that some of that fact-checking is going on during the interviews. So basically, people are starting to call BS when they see BS, as opposed to waiting till after and hoping someone reads the article correcting the facts. I think that is really key to what goes on. It doesn't have to be in a hateful manner, but I think when somebody really has said something, I'm seeing a lot more nationally, at least, and hopefully, you know, locally, everybody will pick up on that, just calling people out when they're just simply wrong about something. I think that's really, really important. And I think that's a good way not to normalize, and that's what we're doing, this atmosphere of sort of reality TV where everything is sensationalism and we begin to accept that. Like you said, Mike, earlier, do you believe what you see? Obviously, people don't believe what they see, because that's why we have somebody who had a whole platform around reality TV and what didn't have to prove up things that he said. So I think it's important that we fact check as we go, and we just keep the metal, you know, foot to the pedal on doing that. And hopefully they'll, enough seeds of doubt will start to be placed that you actually make some, you know, movement.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
I'm not sure there's a whole lot I can add to that. Two great sets of observations there. I would say just it really underscores the importance of being vigilant and being careful and really, really committing yourselves individually to knowing what the real truth is and sticking to it.
Well, there's an interesting extension of all of this that, as you were talking, I'm thinking, we use the term social media, and we also talk about individuals who are quite able to see something happen and quickly either tweet about it, Facebook about it, send information. I'm on the scene. I'm seeing this. Sometimes it's very, very helpful if you're in a flooding situation, fire situation, if local reports coming into some place, et cetera. The role that I understand that good reporting does is to go to an important event, look at it, write it up with reference to its place in a historical context, provide that, and differentiate clearly between what's observed as what being said, these were the things here, and perhaps then also identify implications and perhaps there might be an editorial that would flow from that. But the flow of information from individuals that has not been gone, passed through a filter and edit to just basically substantiate what's being said or look at it from that standpoint means that there's a lot of noise everywhere going back and forth, competing for. The most important thing that my understanding is about all of this is the reader's attention. As a person who wants to be aware of what's happening and knowing that I'm not in Washington, D.C. or Juneau, or perhaps not at every meeting, I have some limited attention. And I'm finding myself, and others have studied this, and they've said, it's all about attention. How do we grab, as a journalist, you know that some headlines grab attention more than others. And that's part of a process. It's part of the process of using the internet, that you want something there that will grab attention. But grabbing attention doesn't necessarily result in a understanding of what is actually happening. And I think the accusation has been placed that the president administration in Washington, the president himself, tends to grab attention. Recently, there was a mention that it's possible that the president's tweeting is more attractive than something which has been an icon of attractiveness, and that is the Super Bowl. I mean, how do you, in these days, I guess the point is, how do we deal with such a deluge of news or attention seeking and still be able to report on something and have it be read?
Boy, that's a big challenge. And it used to be something that I think mostly went without saying. It just was how things were. But, you know, clearly we are in a different time and a different kind of world now.
I think who should be worried about that is Mark Zuckerberg, because there's a fair amount of people that are talking about turning off Facebook now because it's all political and they're feeling that they're not seeing enough puppies and feel-good stories. But it's a powerful tool. But they have to be a little concerned about that faucet being – we're under the fire hose all the time right now. And, you know, maybe it will be a good thing that people will learn to moderate themselves on social media and to start really spending more time actually reading articles as opposed to, you know, little flashes of news, which might shake out better for journalism. But we're just in too big of a storm right now to really figure out what, you know, what we've got generationals that are getting their news way differently. And we're sort of created an attention span for all generations of about the size of a gnat. So how you reverse that is really going to take some methodology, I think.
Well, and that goes right back to the to Mike's observation about headlines and doing something that grabs attention with the proliferation of online information sites, maybe as opposed to news sites. Too many out there just looking for the quick click on the headline. Mm-hmm. And I've seen in my travels through the Facebook news feed plenty of examples of people commenting on just the headline. You can mm-hmm. tell they did not even bother to read the story. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's real work and real challenges that need to be met here.
Well, I think there are two kind of avenues here, and one, and maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I think that people still want to know how their money's being spent, how their tax dollars are being spent, what their elected officials are up to. You know, I'm a reporter for a statewide paper in a local market, and I think people want good local stories that tell them something they don't already know, that tell them something Facebook isn't. I think we do need to look to what people are doing on Facebook and what really is generating a lot of traffic, but that sometimes is the lowest common denominator, which is a problem newspapers have dealt with for as long as there have been newspapers. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. Does that mean we should lead with it? But the other interesting aspect of this administration is, you know, when Donald Trump, when President Trump tweets something, he puts it out there and then watches the news, let's say. And his staffers, who may have been ineffective in trying to get him to maybe not, you know, tweet about Iran, then especially I'm hearing longtime White House staffers are leaking to the media. And then the president is reading their comments or hearing their comments in the media. And so, I mean, in that sense, the media is taking on a far more important role in setting policy as kind of the conduit of information.
Oh, very important point made, right.
And this what happens when he decides to not let certain agencies in? Do you think they'll defend each other? I mean, right now, sort of in the corner is CNN. And we talked about this earlier. I think MSNBC is probably headed to the corner. Do you think they'll start standing up for each other? Or will that even affect?
A lot of reporters, when you tell us you can't know that, it means we dig in harder. So I think that, and if the early days of this White House are any indication, there are any number of staffers who are willing to talk. And so I think that that may, you know, if the administration drives out CNN, drives out MSNBC, what doesn't allow them to see the briefings, they'll go to the, you know, they're off the record sources for. And may get a better story than if they're sitting through briefings.
There seems to be widespread agreement that, you know, these White House press conferences are not super useful anyway. It's just a dog and pony show, and the real reporting goes on outside anyway. So I don't think any administration effort to sideline a particular news agency is going to mean anything to how news gets reported or what news gets reported. Well,
and to be fair, I mean, apples and oranges, but the Obama administration, especially at first, was notoriously untransparent with the media. So, you know, it's a different administration.
You bring up a previous administration.
Nobody likes the media.
We also have examples going back, perhaps most notorious to Nixon and Watergate. Because the information that flowed about the events associated with Watergate came from a source within the administration at a lower level, In that case, it happened to be the FBI, not revealed for 30-some-odd years. But there have been many, many examples of people within the bureaucracy that are sources for the news and probably have a more explicit view of what's happening, et cetera, than people at the top.
I think there's also what might have an effect on it. I know there's at least one organization called Sleeping Giants on Twitter that is starting to call out people that are buying media buys from places like Breitbart, who, you know, have such a one-sided view of what's going on and is pretty much considered a fake news site. And they're starting to call out the media buys to that and saying, for example, X company, you're on this site. So there is, I think, some of that backdoor peer pressure might push some of that to settle out too. But maybe that's too optimistic.
Well,
it is about money, though, right?
I wanted to have both Terry and Saz have an opportunity to throw in here on a topic that we discussed last week. I'd like to also segue then to an example of what is an ongoing process here. The most recent big activity in terms of meetings has involved the school board. The school board had a very well-attended meeting this week, and it is in the process of finalizing its budget. The school district has very carefully over time made some significant efforts to be transparent in their process. Certainly, both on their website, meetings that are coming up this week that allow people to look at, ask questions, make comments, et cetera, around their process. That seems to be a very local example of perhaps how to do it well. But Terry, you have been to the most recent meeting and so on. You've been watching this for a long time. Do you see this local example as an attempt to provide information and to do it not by ignoring the press, but in involving the press and as well being obviously having to make some hard decisions because these are budget questions, but where would you place an entity like the school district at the present time?
Well, I don't think the school district's all that much different than what Governor Walker's trying to do. They've been trying to bring the public into the conversation, but unfortunately, people don't like to talk about money, and it's hard to understand. They're complex. As transparent as you make these budgets, and particularly I think at the school district, it's even harder. It's hard to understand if that's not your gig, if you're just not a math person. I think the district does as good a job as anybody trying to get it out there to the public. They're not only trying to educate the public, they're trying to educate the assembly, who ultimately is going to provide them with 24% of their budget, and then the state, who has the rest of it, basically, except for a small amount from the federal. And they're in the unenviable position of not being able to raise revenues themselves. The borough comes up a little short. They can change a mill rate that hasn't been, changed since 2009. But the school district can't do that. We don't have a school district like some outside where they can go to the taxpayers and say, hey, we opened 5 new schools. We have increased costs. We've added these many programs. We need a little more. They don't have that luxury. So I think they are in a position they're trying just about throw everything on the wall to see what sticks to try to get the public attention. And this last school board meeting that you talked about, Mike, they're now looking again about outsourcing a couple of whole departments, nutrition service and the custodians, which I know Zaz was reporting that time. She can probably give you a good indication how tough that was. Is that a good approach? Doesn't fill the hole, and it only fills the pain from a couple of departments, and it's something that has not been very successful. So I don't know, maybe Zaz can weigh in more on the history of that.
Well, I mean, I was reporting at that time. I don't remember reporting on that particular issue. We did. But there is an audit, I believe, was done of the pros and cons of that privatization. I'm going to be talking with Luke Fulp about getting a copy of that audit because You know, I think the advantage to the district in even weighing the privatization of that custodial and nutrition services contract is it's unknown, but a chunk of money with a $9.9 million deficit this year. You know, the downside, at least before, was maybe quality of service in the schools, continuity. I mean, my second grader is on an in-school field trip today with Mr. Russell, the custodian at the school at Shaw Elementary. And, you know, he's been there for a while. He knows kids' names. You know, he's part of the fabric of the school. And I think a lot of the custodial staff who've spent any number of time in the school do get very familiar with students. So, but at least there is a case study we can look at. How did it work? What were the pros? What were the cons? To inform the process.
Yeah, and I think that's some of the angst that why you saw a 4-3 vote, because I think some of the members didn't feel like all the costs of the last time it happened, which is not that long ago, were really on the table for them to see. And there were a lot of teachers in the room, not just custodians, 122 that'll lose their job, but teachers that actually did have that effect. And you know, is it the right approach? I think that's what the three that didn't vote for it felt like. We need more information because we don't even want to put it out there and spend the money to put it out there again if we haven't learned the lessons of the past and what that process cost us.
The last time it was outsourced, was that for 2 years?
It was a 3-year contract, I think.
A 3-year contract.
Well, I think we can draw something from this discussion, though. It appears to me that whether you're in Washington, D.C., you've got a complex set of problems, really complex, worldwide, all kinds of things happening. The school district also has a complex set of difficulties. They're juggling a lot of variables and all the rest of that. I think the difference in approach, though, is kind of interesting to me. I think it stands in contrast to say that the school board, the school district, is working to have the discussion, put the information out, and go from there. It's not I haven't heard many tweets coming from the school district headquarters that says, we're doing this, and that's it. And I think that may be as good an example as we have of why, if you can do it locally, and it actually, even though it's hard, it's all kinds of stuff there, it's still a better feeling than what's being expressed at the present time about the unknowns associated with what will he do next by tweet.
I think it's safe to say that Gene Stone and Donald Trump have very different personalities and
different
management
styles.
Okay. Well, I want to thank the three of you for coming in today and spending time here as we speak both broadly and very specifically. I want to thank Zaz Hollander. Thank you, Zaz.
Great to be here. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah, Sider. I don't want to go without giving a shout-out to Great Alaska Schools today, who are fielding phone calls on behalf of Senator Sullivan to weigh in for people that have not been able to get a hold of his office to weigh in on the nomination of the Secretary of Education that Alaskans have spoke loudly that they do not want confirmed next week. So go to their Facebook page and you can find out how to get them to register your comments for him.
Yeah, whatever they might be.
Whatever they might be.
And Mark Kelsey. Thank you, Mark.
See you next week.
All right. Take care. We're finished with another edition of Valley Edition.